having said that, I want to tell you the story about part of my extended family that might seem ridiculous. I have a family member who's a huge hockey fan, comes from a hockey family, had a relative that was an early hockey Olympian. I mean, hockey's in the blood of this crew. And fortunately is married to someone who does more than just tolerate his fanness. His wife is also a fan of sorts. And as it turns out, someone who absolutely loves Wayne Gretzky. Now, despite my own lack of hockey savvy or innate passion, I do know that Mr. Gretzky no longer plays the game. He's moved to the other side of the bench and the paycheck signing, so I know this much. But but back in the day, when he was a hockey hero, this family member of mine bought his wife a life-sized cardboard cutout of Wayne Gretzky. And presumably so she could always have him around. And then he put it, so help me, he put it in the bedroom. And not in the bed, I'm pleased to say, but he did put it in the bedroom. He sort of put it around, I know. He just sort of put it around the corner so when she came in, it'd be like, oh, Wayne, you're here, you know. It's a surprise, anyway. If I didn't know these people as well as I do, and if I didn't think as highly of them as I do, I'd be concerned, you know. But as it turns out, it's just part of their zaniness. It's just part of his sense of humor and her ability to roll with that sense of humor. And in the end, of course, it's not like it was actually Wayne. I mean, it's a cardboard cutout. It's a facsimile, right? It's a representation. It's not the thing or the person itself. And I think some people would say that there's a kinship between that Wayne character and the character of the unmerciful servant in this parable that we've been looking at. Lots of folks, I think, would say that's not a very real character. That's like a cardboard cutout. And in particular, the character, if you remember the parable, for those of you that kind of haven't been tracking along, I mean, it's a familiar story of Jesus's, but the short version is there's a servant who owes the king an enormous unpayable debt. He comes in, pleads for forgiveness. The king forgives his debt. He goes out and beats up a servant that owes him $100 because that person can't pay him. That's the unmerciful servant character's behavior in a nutshell. And that feels to a lot of people who look at that story like it's a caricature. Like it's sort of like that character's behavior is sort of a facsimile or a cartoon figure of wickedness. It's not very believable. It's not the thing itself. It lacks dimension. Because really, how would anybody outside of a comic book or a graphic novella, how could anybody outside of a caricatured environment actually fail to see that having been forgiven a multi-million dollar debt and freed from slavery to boot, you just don't, as your very next action, go and try and beat $100 out of some poor sap that you know that's still a slave. You just don't behave like that. And so, in the face of the unbelievability of that behavior, some people would say that character in that story, and of course it's a character in a story, but that character in that story just is not a believable representation of the issues here. So they're a caricature. Well, I can appreciate, given the extremity of the character's behavior, how somebody might go there. That said, I wonder if maybe we go there sometimes because the alternative might be a little bit uncomfortable for all of us, because the alternative to the unmerciful servant being a cardboard cutout is that the unmerciful servant is ordinary. That, in fact, that character is like us. Maybe we could think of it this way. We talked last week about how the servant, when he pleads for mercy, says that if the mercy is granted, he'll pay back his debt. And he actually seems to think that his master is responding to that offer when he forgives the debt and sets him free. That he actually seems to believe that the king forgives the debt because he promised to pay it back. And in that dilemma, we see that the unmerciful servant has a couple of real perception problems. One is that he just doesn't seem to have a shred of a notion of grace in his mind in all of this. He can't seem to begin to imagine someone that doesn't function like him. And he can't imagine any other reason why the king would let him off the hook unless it's because he was actually dumb enough to believe that the servant was actually going to pay back this enormous debt. What the servant seems to know is that he needs to be saved from a situation, but the only kind of savior that he can imagine is one that's so dumb that if it wasn't for plain luck, the savior would have been in the poorhouse long since. Because that's what happens to people who go around forgiving enormous debts like that, right? And the other problem that he seems to have is that he has no grasp at all of what the king had to do to forgive his debt. Because what the king had to do was choose to make no calculations about profit and loss. What he had to do was essentially drop dead to the entire business of bookkeeping, like the unjust judge in the parable that we considered, who had to put himself out of the judging business entirely in order to respond to the widow's plea. And it's kind of like all the servant knows in this parable is that the heat was on, but now it's off. But he has no grasp at all of what it cost the king to put out the fire. And maybe that's why he responds to the servant that owes him $100 with so little imagination and so little empathy. I want to camp out on empathy just for a minute. Lots of sources I could have gone to for this, but this one I kind of resonated with because it's an organization that works with disadvantaged kids, and the key to their way of working with those kids is empathy. And they talk about empathy in that setting this way. This is their definition. This is the Wyman Center. Empathy, which is the identification with or vicarious experiencing of the feelings, thoughts, or attitudes of another, though similar to sympathy, goes one step further. Sympathy simply creates a relationship between persons or things, whereas the act of empathy moves one to deeply experience another's emotions. Empathy causes us to act or prevent actions, and it helps us to understand how others may be struggling, which can then lead to solutions or a commitment to help. This is how we can change the world. Their words. Mike, I appreciated in a unique way, because I knew I was going to touch on this idea, listening to you wrestle for just this when you talked about the crisis in Syria and Iraq. The idea of empathy doesn't necessarily lead us into tidy terrain. It leads us into an enormously complex terrain. And the illustration I'm going to use is in danger, of course, of reducing something complicated to something less complex, but I'm going to use it anyway with that caveat. If we think about the human psyche as sort of like a collection of building blocks, all of which have a critical role to play in creating a full-orbed human being, then this servant seems to be missing the empathy brick. It's just kind of not there. He can't seem to empathize and I'll use directional language for this again, despite its limitations. He can't seem to empathize in either direction in this parable. He can't empathize up to the king. He can't seem to imagine what the king has had to give up in order to put out the fire of this unpayable debt. And he can't seem to empathize down to the other servant. He can't seem to recall, even for a few moments, what it felt like in his own life when the heat was on. And as the parable timeline gives it to us, that wasn't that long before. He can't seem to remember what it felt like when he was pleading for his life. It's just not there. And if we want a caricature of that, it might be the person who makes this kind of desperate deal with God while they're heaving their guts out over the toilet bowl, but then they wake up the next morning feeling a little more sober and sane and say, you know, deals made under duress don't count. Right? It's like, yeah, I know, but I was sick then, you know? It's kind of like that. But when we get into this terrain, we might protest, no, but who are you talking about? Because I have empathy. I'm not that guy. I'm not that cardboard cutout. I can feel for the other person. I would never behave like that. Well, I'm not going to speak for you in this one. That's not my job. But what I can tell you is that I can identify with the unmerciful servant. And what I mean is not that I'm going to start, you know, strong-arming people either materially or spiritually. What I mean is that, like the unmerciful servant, I often don't like to think about the magnitude of what I have been forgiven, whether I understand that in sort of cosmic terms, forgiven by God, or whether I think about that in a relational realm of human to human. I don't like to think about what sort of picture of justice the forgiver has had to let go of in order for the forgiveness to be offered. And furthermore, I don't like to think about what it would take in my own life to follow that path of forgiveness. Because, as far as I can tell, the king in this story basically had to die to a lifetime of bookkeeping. He had to let go entirely of what he was entitled to. And if the servant had even an inkling of that, it seems to me he would certainly have responded differently to the guy that owed him money, but he doesn't appear to have even a clue that this might be the case. Maybe in the way that we sometimes know things without knowing how we know them, maybe in that way the unmerciful servant knows in his gut that if he goes down the path that the king has shown him, he's going to have to do some dying of his own, not the least part of which will be forgiving his fellow servant for the legitimate debt that he owes him. That if he walks down this path, that's part of what it's going to cost. That's all speculation, of course. It's what parables invite us to do. So the unmerciful servant, having gone out into the world without empathy or compassion and having been busted by his fellow servants for his bad behavior, his fellow servants, by the way, seem to want to live in a good society where we kind of pay it forward when someone gives us a gift like forgiveness. The unmerciful servant seems indifferent to that. And in any event, when he behaves the way that he does, his fellow servants kind of call him out. And he gets called back on the carpet before the king. And the king, and this is where lots of people get stuck in this parable, the king, who clearly has the capacity for grace and forgiveness, essentially says to the servant, "Have it your way." I don't know how I feel about that idea, but it seems to be the way the story behaves. And the king makes it clear in the process what the only grounds are for someone being condemned. And I'll get onto that in a moment. But one of the reasons people get stuck in this parable is because it fits so tidily into our notions of God as somebody who's, at the risk of giving Prince Machiavelli yet another smudge on his name, who's Machiavellian, who's going to get you coming and going. And because we often start with that paradigm, that God's just waiting for an excuse to wallop us for failure, it's super easy to read the end of this parable as a confirmation of that. That God's capricious, forgives with one hand, punishes with the other, knowingly with both. I don't think that's what's going on here. And part of the reason I would say that is because the king, in the process of addressing himself to this slow-to-learn servant, makes it clear what the only grounds are for someone being condemned. Because clearly in this parable, the unmerciful servant is not condemned for having racked up an unconscionable debt. First part of the parable just lays that out as clear as a story could. There is no way under heaven or hell that the servant in this story could ever, ever repay the magnitude of the debt that they owe. The debt is forgiven, not because of the offer of repayment, but because of the request for mercy. The king, for the king's own reasons, absorbs the debt because the servant asks them to. That forgiveness goes nowhere in this story until the servant chooses for it to go elsewhere. And I think this is very important. The debt was forgiven just for the asking without any expectation of that gift of forgiveness ever being paid back. The only thing the servant needs to do to know the full experience of the freedom that the king has offered is to walk out the door and live in it. The only thing the servant needs to do to know that experience is to accept the gift that they have been offered. I use the word only advisedly. But to do that, the servant would have had to give some consideration to the magnitude of what the king has done. And that is where the empathy for his fellow servant would have had a chance to grow. So as the Wyman Folk Center we read a few moments ago would say, the forgiven servant would be caused to act or to prevent actions, would be helped to understand how the other may be struggling and to seek solutions or make a commitment to help to change the world. But if the king had to die to his rights to give the gift of a forgiven debt, so the servant has to die to his right to repayment in order to act in an empathetic way, because that's what breaks the chain and carries empathy into the course of the story. And that's what doesn't happen here. Because that's the one thing that this servant can't seem to imagine. And so the king says to the servant, have it your way. Not have it my way. This is an important point about how we imagine the actions of a deity in the lives of us everyday kind of folks. We'll come back to this a little bit more, but one of the ways to understand this, and often when you're trying to illustrate things that are kind of cosmic and enormous, you end up, at least I end up feeling like I need to give either or illustrations. I hate doing that. You know that if you've been around here any length of time. I often don't know how else to enter the idea. So I think one of the dilemmas that this story casts us into is that we want to be able to imagine kind of an immutable binary grid for the behavior of God. We want to be able to kind of set up a way of thinking about God that has really crisply drawn, heavily demarked rules about how God will behave so that we can know if we're playing inside the rules or not. When in fact, it seems much more that what God has done is given us an enormous amount of agency in the story. A tremendous amount of freedom to choose how we will behave. And that those choices have a tremendous impact on how the story goes. They do not dictate it. Any of us who've lived a minute with our head up and our eyes open know that things happen in life that we can't look at and go, oh yeah, if only I hadn't, that wouldn't have. You know? Shit happens, is the short version. Okay? Yes, it does. And that doesn't fit that tidy idea of a grid for God's behavior. But we take that kind of tendency. One of the reasons we have the tendency, of course, is because it helps us rein in the vagaries of life, right? It helps us rein in the unpredictability of life, which terrifies us, generally speaking, as humans. The thought that something could happen that just was totally beyond our control and we couldn't do anything to cause it or uncause it. Ah! Right? Like, if that doesn't make the kind of hair stand up on the back of the neck of our whole life, then nothing will. That fear is enormous in us. And so we want to try to address ourselves to that fear. One of the things that religion often does is offer an easy redress of that fear by saying, this is the character and nature of God. It's bounded by these ideas. And if you just learn those ideas and you behave them properly, you can live in a world where that kind of stuff doesn't happen. And if it does, you'll know exactly what it means. You'll know that you didn't have enough faith or you got outside the rules or you know, whatever, right? You got into the realm where you know God's pissed, so don't go there. So you blew it. God whacked you because you stepped over. Like, that's how that grid kind of way of thinking about this whole dilemma behaves. Well, one of the reasons that's so appealing is because it puts the control of God back in the realm of our ideas about God. It puts it back on us. Sorry. If you came to church to hear the preacher affirm that, it's not going to happen, as you may have guessed. And there, I can point you to places where it would. And I'm not saying they have no value. I'm just saying this isn't that place. I think what's happening in this moment in the story is I'm going to call it a feng shui moment. I'm going to say this is about spiritual architecture, if you want. What I mean by that is that it seems like this is a part of the story where the character gets to choose what kind of an environment they want to live in. That's different than saying this is where the character gets to choose exactly how everything that happens in the environment will go. As you know, if you've ever been in an environment where something happened that you weren't expecting, but the environment was familiar, right? Like home. Oh, never saw that coming, but I know where I am. That's what I mean by environment. The king in this story is offering the servant an environment of grace. He's offering the servant the opportunity to live a way of life that is permeated with the freely offered gift of forgiveness. He's offering the servant an opportunity to live in a world where receiving the gift of forgiveness requires nothing more than dying to the idea that it can be earned. And he's offering the opportunity to live in that environment, knowing that living there requires an awareness of the cost of the gift received, and that that in turn is what generates empathy, which helps the person who lives in that environment of grace to carry the essence of that gift into the world. You can't be an empathetic human without it costing you something. I can't be an empathetic human without it costing me something. Because this goes beyond sympathy. This is where I actually feel that other feeling. This is where I actually bear something of that other burden. It's going to take something out of my happy, boundaried life if I let your pain in. And it's going to take something out of yours if you let mine in. By the way, the same thing is going to happen if you let my happiness in. It's just a different emotion. It takes up space to walk with other humans, to be empathetic. It just does. And so when the servant makes the choice that he does in this story, he isn't reversing the king's offer of freedom. He is refusing to live in it. I've said it before, it's a theme that I wrestle with in my own life, to live out the belief of. It remains something I would say I believe. We are not victims in this spiritual narrative. We are actors. We are choosers. We are characters who are dignified with options. And I realize, even as I say it, that's like the man who has food in his cupboard saying to the person on the curb who doesn't, you know, you'd be happier if you went home and made some dinner. I get that there is an inherent dilemma in my saying that. I live a life in which I get to act like a chooser. Having said that, I still believe it. I don't believe we all have the same range of choice. And that's an enormous problem in the world in which we live. And one of the reasons to pursue empathy, by the way, because if we actually are willing to walk with others, I think the range of choices for all the actors will get bigger. But I believe that we're dignified with options. I believe among those options is the choice to either accept the forgiveness that is always and forever on offer and walk free in the way that that provides freedom. But to do that, we have to give up our own right to live in a world that is governed by the keeping of accounts. And that is an extremely costly idea. We can insist on living in a world of scorekeeping. We can choose to live in a world in which moral bookkeeping is insisted on. But if we do, what we're going to experience, and what I think can carry on forever, is just the pointless torture that that has always been. I don't actually know of any story about living in that realm that has anything remotely like a happy ending. I think it's a version of hell, but it's one that looks so plausible to us, and it's so hard to step away from. Matthew 18:18, we were looking at a parable a couple of weeks ago about this forgiving someone who's wronged you. And I realize any time you talk about this stuff, we're in the realm where we tend to get binary and go, well, if I forgive someone, what does that mean about how I live? It was a little bit like, I was thinking about this the other day, and I was thinking, no, you still, even if you forgive the truck driver for not checking the air tank and coming barreling towards you down the hill, you still step to the side so they go past you and not over you. And so there's a whole realm of how do we live this out that, I acknowledge the complexity of. I'm not trying to illustrate these ideas the way I am so we can go and get binary on somebody's ass that offended us, you know. Matthew 18:18, that parable about how to deal with somebody who's wronged you, includes, Jesus says, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. If any of you have ever kind of lived around name it and claim it theology, you know this is a key little verse. I was in the grocery store the other day, and I saw a familiar person, somebody I haven't seen for many years. And they were, you know, we were both getting our groceries, and I was kind of coming down the aisle that they were on, and I said hello. And I said, "How are you?" Which is, and I meant it. I wasn't just trying to get past her to the flower. And she said, "Why? Does it just ooze off of me?" I said, "Well, I wasn't sort of feeling that. I wanted to know how you were doing." And poosh. Out came the story. And I'm not going to tell you the story because I didn't ask them if I could. But as part of that story, this person went into this whole realm of kind of talking about kicking the devil to the curb, you know. There's an entire realm of belief here about the nature of the spiritual world that is fairly common, but which many tenets of which I don't share. And one of the pivots of that entire realm is this text: whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And I want to recast that for us just a little bit here. It's a different way to imagine it. I'm not suggesting that that person can't carry on with the implications of their imagination of this, or that you all need to believe like I'm about to suggest about this. But here's another possibility. The other possibility, I think, then what that means is name it and claim it, to make really short form of that whole shape of belief about this, is that when Jesus says those kinds of things in the context of parabolic speech, which is where that phrase is found in Scripture, in the context of a parable, a story that's meant to make us go, huh? He's doing the same thing as he's doing in this story when he says to the servant, "Have it your way." What kind of realm do you want to live in? Do you want to live in a realm in which grace is the pervasive shape of the environment? Or do you want to live in a realm in which account keeping is the pervasive shape of the environment? Because you get to choose. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever is bound in heaven will be bound on earth. You get to choose how much of what's always on offer of the goodness of God permeates the everyday events of your life. This is not an offer of a guarantee. And if you do, you're going to be rich and you're going to be healthy, and it's just not there. It's just not in the it's not in the story as we have it. And yet, we are actors and choosers. And one of the ways that it helps me to imagine this is environmental. It's about what kind of things we wish to labor to bring into the environment in which everyday life happens. I'm not saying it's a switch that you flick. I'm saying it's a labor that we do. And we're formed by it. It's not a choice you make once and it's always made. If you've ever had to forgive anything, you know that. If you've ever had to be forgiven for something, especially something that you seem to keep doing, you know that. It won't fall to that kind of simplicity. It just won't. We have to practice it. I have three possible illustrations of this at the end of my notes, none of which I finished off. And I got a fourth one on a drive-in, on a radio interview I was listening to. So help me. The need for us to understand what it's like to be in the other person's shoes is so essential to how we practice this. It's just everywhere around us. And people who aren't considering the parables of Jesus are seeing it from another vantage point because it's just present in the world. I'm going to leave you with what I think is a relatively fun and imaginative take on this, just to kind of let it spin. There's a she's a filmmaker and author. She's a performance artist. A woman named Miranda July. She's invented and is distributing. You can get it for yourself this afternoon if you want. It's a new app. It's called Somebody. And what the app does is it equips you with this particular piece of technology to send a message to somebody else that also has this app, but that could be a complete stranger on the other end of the situation, to send them a message which you wish to have delivered in person to another person. And then they go deliver it. Yes, I know. Try to imagine this. It's alarming at one level. At another level, it just kind of makes your mind boggle. She uses the app and has fascinating stories about what it's like to be the deliverer of this message. What Ms. July is after, and she also has a short film about this, by the way, just premiered at the Venice Film Festival last month. But in the interview, I'm not going to get into it any more than that. Maybe we'll talk about it more another day when we have some more time. But in the interview I heard her do on this, she said one thing that feels like it just keys to what we're talking about this morning. She said, when the chips are down, we will use the muscle that we've been exercising. And so what she's trying to do is say, I want to encourage people to exercise the muscle of relationship, human to human, not machine to machine. And so even when I need to communicate across distance, I'm going to send that to a human. And the app comes with a map and directions for how you can find the recipient. And, you know, like the whole thing. It's really quite fascinating, the amount of work that's gone into this whole thing and the thought. And as she would be the first to say, it's not refined. It's going to get better. But just try to imagine this for a moment. Just go ahead and go there. Dear Susan, I'm making up a name. I don't love you anymore. And I'd like to not see you again. Goodbye. Send. But it didn't go to Susan. It went to Mike. And Mike got it, and he shares the app. And he has to, and there's the map, and Susan's having coffee at the Starbucks right now, and his job is to go to Susan and empathetically, because this is the key to how this thing works, with the emotion that is attendant to that human-to-human communication, to go to Susan and deliver it. That message. I'm not saying it's a good solution to every dilemma. But isn't that interesting? I think it's another way of a human going, how can I and we together learn what it's like to be in human shoes in these kind of dilemmas instead of distancing ourselves from this? How can we learn, if you want to put it into the realm of the parable, how can we learn what it's like to be in God's shoes in some of these dilemmas? There's a thing to wrestle with in our imagination. What's it cost to put out the fire that I make every day? That might generate a little empathy. What's it cost for my spouse? What's it cost for my kid? What's it cost for my colleague? I should also say it was not self-evident if you came for a tidy answer this morning. I acknowledge that this is bound to have disappointed. But I'm glad to have company on the journey of figuring it out as we go along together. Peace to you all.